Thank you. May it please the court, good afternoon. Alan Epstein, representing Snoozy's Furniture Company. With me at council table is Michael Wathen. Defendant raises two issues on appeal in support of its argument that it's entitled to a new trial in this case. The first is whether the trial court erred in precluding evidence of plaintiff's pending criminal charges. And this issue has several parts. First, whether evidence of the charges was relevant to plaintiff's non-economic damages and physical impairment claims. And second, whether plaintiff's counsel's comments on plaintiff's credibility and integrity opened the door to evidence of the criminal charges by injecting plaintiff's character into the trial. Evidence of other crimes or acts generally is not admissible to show a party's character, but is admissible for other purposes. RTD and Snoozy's argued in response to plaintiff's motion in limine to preclude introduction of the two sexual assault charges that, based on medical reports, these pending charges were contributing to plaintiff's non-economic damages, claims of pain, emotional distress, and impairment of quality of life, and physical impairment claim, and so that evidence of these charges should be admissible. Any potential prejudice could have been cured with a limiting instruction. Before the start of trial, the court ruled that this evidence would be precluded under Rule 403. Then, during trial, defendant's counsel sought to introduce evidence of the altercation between plaintiff and his housekeeper, which incident was the basis for the criminal charges, not to impart the criminal charges themselves to the jury, but to show that plaintiff's claimed physical injuries were attributable to a potential cause other than the accident. And the trial court precluded this evidence as well. Defendant submits it was entitled to introduce this evidence because it was relevant to its damages defense.
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Epstein? I hear your argument, and it's relevant, and it sounds like the plaintiff did recover some damages for distress and all that. I get that. The trial court, I think, said it was relevant. He agreed that, but ultimately looked at the 403 balancing and said, evidence of allegations of sexual kind of abuse or misconduct are totally unfairly prejudicial. And so focusing on that, let's accept your argument that there was some relevance to this evidence. Why is it an abuse of discretion for the court to have said, but the prejudice far overwhelms any probative value?
Admittedly, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. It's defendant's position that it was so relevant to the critical issues in this case that the potential prejudice was curable with a limiting instruction. With respect to the incident between the altercation between plaintiff and his housekeeper, the criminal charges for that purpose would not have come in at all. Just the altercation itself to show that could have been a cause of his injuries, so that really shouldn't have played a role in the determination of whether that incident itself was inadmissible. But the standard of review is abuse of discretion under Rule 403.
Can you take us back to the context of? As I understand it, this gentleman was injured by your client, a van being driven, and he was struck, and liability was admitted, so we're talking about damages. So what was the state of the evidence at the time that you tried to offer this evidence of criminal charges? How did you try to relate it? What's unique about it that would take it outside of the problem we're trying to address here?
Are you asking whether it would only have that evidence would only have been relevant to liability, or at what stage of the procedure?
No, I'm trying to see the context in which you're offering it to see if somehow it relates to what you're trying to prove. And why it wasn't outweighed by the fact that you're bringing in this stuff that doesn't relate to the contact with the van.
The injuries claimed from the contact from the accident were pain and suffering and emotional distress and future economic damages. The medical reports that the defendant received indicated that the residual injuries, damages plaintiff sustained, resulted in part from these criminal charges that were weighing on his mind. So it was, that's why they were relevant to damages and his ability to recover, and or his ability to recover from the impact of the automobile accident.
And so my understanding is that there was a report, a psychologist report by Dr. Hinston, that involved several stressors, that this was one of them. Did that report, or did evidence, did testimony come in about the other major stressors, the recent loss of a wife to cancer, legal battles with her family, the struggles to maintain custody of his son, the difficulties of being a single parent, the financial difficulties caused by changing his work schedule to accommodate his chronic pain from the accident? Did all those other stressors get introduced
at trial?
Yeah.
No, they did not.
So this was the only one that they were wanting to get in as far as the other stressors?
The other stressors did not come in at trial.
All right. So why would that be an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court when all of these other stressors weren't even introduced into the trial?
Well, arguably they could have been introduced. The criminal charges were, defense counsel believed, was the most significant of those other stressors. And Dr. Hinston was, plaintiff argues that this evidence was, not admitting the evidence was harmless error because Dr. Hinston was not listed as a will call witness, but she was listed on the trial management order, and defendant cross-examined Dr. Kumar regarding Dr. Hinston's report. But more importantly, the trial court ruled that Dr. Hinston would not be permitted to talk about the criminal charges, so the prejudice had already occurred, and there was no point in listing her at that point. In any event, plaintiff's counsel during trial opened the door to the criminal charges by saying in opening statement that plaintiff was an honest and decent man and that he was proud to represent him. That statement opened the door to permit defendant to impeach plaintiff's credibility with evidence that there were these two pending criminal charges against him at the time.
Didn't the court, and forgive me, I'm not remembering the record, Your Honor, but I thought the court admonished counsel about that or said that's not proper or made some statement about that. I do recognize counsel did it again in closing, so I hear that. But didn't the court make some kind of statement on the record that it wasn't proper and the jury should ignore it?
I think the judge may have said that it was not proper. I don't remember whether the judge instructed the jury to ignore it, but it was there in the trial as a statement that the jury heard, and at that point it's our argument that plaintiff's counsel injected plaintiff's credibility and honesty into the proceedings, and that defendant was entitled to impeach that statement.
Don't you have to have a conviction for that?
Sorry?
There has to be a conviction to impeach, right?
I don't think there has to be a conviction. I think that it was relevant for there to have been a charge.
Okay. Did any evidence... I'm just trying to understand the record, and forgive me. Was there any evidence about whether Mr. Khan was a good and decent man or anything like that? I mean, I assume the jury was instructed here that the arguments of counsel are not evidence. So was there any evidence relating to that? I guess what I'm struggling with is, why does a statement of counsel in an opening statement open the door to a charge of criminal conduct?
Well, there's a rule of professional conduct that prohibits counsel from saying anything like that during his argument. That's why it is precluded under the rules of professional responsibility.
Are you aware of any case law that says, and I'm not quibbling with you, I do think the statements were improper. Is there any case law that says that opens the door, an improper statement, an opening statement like that? Would make me a little nervous because, right or wrong, I've heard many, many lawyers say stuff like that.
Well, there is no case law specifically on the issue in the context of these precise facts. There is case law that if otherwise inadmissible evidence is brought up by a party that then seeks to preclude its introduction or was seeking to preclude its introduction, that opens the door.
Even if brought up in like an opening statement, an argument of counsel, that's what I'm trying to isolate.
It's typically in examination of a witness, but I'm aware of no cases that say that saying something in opening statement does not open the door because it is not evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. I know your time is limited and you may want to save some time for rebuttal. Can I just ask you on the continuance issue, what issues were left to be resolved after the surgery? In other words, what would you have wanted to know that you didn't know by the time you moved for continuance? Surgery is over. Mr. Khan says, I'm feeling great, no more pain. What else did you need to know?
Well, the opinion upon which defendant relied was the opinion of physiatrist that his physical status and function would not be resolved for 6 to 12 months after the surgery. And the issues to which defendant argued that period of time was necessary to resolve his physical condition was because defendant could not effectively explore plaintiff's claimed permanent impairment and future earning capacity damages until those physical conditions had resolved to the point where we knew where he was at the time of trial. Plaintiff testified he was pain-free, but pain was only one component of the non-economic damage and physical impairment damages.
So in other words, he was still seeking permanent impairment and future earning capacity, and your argument here is that at the time, after that second surgery, we didn't know what that was going to look like because we needed to wait 6 to 12 months?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. You've got 2 minutes and 16 seconds, I think, left.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Lloyd Kordick, and my registration number is 6298. With reference to the issues in the case, Your Honor, there was no allegation of sexual assault in this case. It was improper sexual touching with a housekeeper that my client had hired, and
I sincerely apologize. I think I misstated that, and I recognize what you say. My apologies.
I understand. And, you know, my client, the evidence was he had moved to the United States in 1984. He has no prior or subsequent criminal record except these charges, which occurred after the two automobile accidents. In the two accidents, they were both clear liability accidents in which the defendants admitted liability. There is no question that he had herniations at two levels in his neck, and subsequently there was a surgery, a double fusion in his neck. With reference to the motion in limine, Your Honor, we filed a motion in limine to keep these misdemeanor charges out of evidence, and I think it's telling what the defense response was. It's summarized in paragraph 11. They said, the jury should be allowed to learn the details of the significant and extreme nature of the extraneous events in the life of the plaintiff as evidence to support the conclusions of Dr. Henston and Dr. Bass that the plaintiff's physical condition and his healing were affected by those stressors. So the sole reason that they opposed the motion in limine was because of proposed testimony of Dr. Henston and Dr. Bass. Dr. Henston, a psychologist, saw Mr. Kahn a single time, and in that interview, he refused to take a screening test for depression, and he refused to take a screening test for anxiety, and he specifically, she reports, denied that he was depressed and denied that he was suffering anxiety. And there was no evidence at trial that he suffered anxiety or depression. No testimony.
Counsel.
Yes.
You were claiming damages for emotional distress, is that right? And you recovered them from the jury? Or is that not right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so why wouldn't the defendant be able to take the position then that you got to look at all of the possible sources of emotional distress, jury, and decide which is attributable to the accident and which is attributable to a source outside of the accident? And along those lines, why wouldn't pending criminal charges of improper sexual touching be relevant to an argument that it contributed to the plaintiff's emotional distress?
Well, Judge, if I could back up a little bit. First of all, the defendant could have raised that same argument in their opposition to our motion in limine. The problem is they never raised that as one of their objections. They limited their objections to relevance to the testimony of Dr. Henston and Dr. Bass. But had they raised that, and I'll go there, I'm not trying to deny you, I think that the question for the judge in this case is to do a 403 balancing test. You know, even he said that even if this is relevant, and he stated their argument specifically as to why it was relevant, even if this is relevant, an illegal sexual touching claim is so inflammatory to a jury that any relevance it would have was outweighed by the prejudice, which is an abuse of discretion standard. And as this court's aware, the Supreme Court said that in order to be an abuse of discretion, the decision must be manifestly arbitrary or unreasonable.
See, but that's my concern sort of on the flip side too, is on the one hand, it is inflammatory. But on the other hand, and your client had no history of any kind of a criminal charge, so why wasn't the fact that there was this pending criminal charge of something involving improper sexual touching, why wouldn't that be a source of emotional distress for anybody in that situation that should be taken into account by a jury?
Well, for one thing, Judge, most of these stressors existed before his accidents, and he was working full-time, and there were numerous witnesses, customers, and other mechanics that testified as to what a superb mechanic he was and what a good businessman he was and what a good job he did and how they trusted him. I mean, this was overwhelming evidence at trial. So he was functioning properly without pain, even though he had the stressors. He had these accidents within 5 months of each other, and he was in excruciating pain, and he couldn't perform his duties. He then had surgery, and he had a structural defect corrected, and immediately after the surgery, his pain went away and has remained gone since that time. So there's no evidence to support that he was suffering any kind of a depressive disorder as a result of this that would have affected those. The defendant had the option of calling Dr. Bass and Dr. Henston. They did not call either of them. And in fact, Dr. Bass, all she said was, she never mentioned these charges. All she said was, other factors in his life. She said, her opinion was, arbitrarily I'm going to assign one third to the first accident, one third to the second accident, and other factors in his life, not describing what they were. Now, they chose not to call her as a witness. She was on the will call. We expected her to be called, and we wanted her called. And when they told us during trial they weren't going to call her, we asked the court if we could call her, and the court gave us permission. Because of the weather at that time, she was scheduled and couldn't get out of her house to come in and would have to reschedule. She lives up in the mountains somewhere. And the court said, I'm going to continue the case until next week to have her come in. And we made the strategic decision not to call her. But they did not intend to call this Ms. Bass, and they did nothing. There was no attempt to subpoena Henston or bring her in as a witness on these issues, which they could have done. So, I mean, the whole issue that their opposition to the motion was based on the testimony of two witnesses they had no intentions of calling, and for which they made no offer of proof to the court as to what their testimony would have been. And that's, basically my argument on that.
Mr. Gorder, can I ask you, you got some damages for emotional distress, among other things, as I recall. What was your evidence of Mr. Cohen's emotional distress?
His only distress was, Your Honor, he couldn't work. He had a child, and he had a large business going, and he tried to operate it with employees, and he couldn't afford the employees. He laid them off. And the only thing he could do was diagnostic tests, which he did continue to do, that didn't require him to bend over. And that he suffered, severe economic stress, not being able to pay his bills, either his medical bills or the bills relative to his business. That was the only evidence. There was no evidence of depression. He never testified, I'm depressed. In fact, I don't think he was depressed. I mean, he continued to try to do things to make a living and continue to operate his business at a much reduced level. And the evidence at trial was from his surgeon. He said, they asked him on cross-examination, well, don't all these psychological things create the pain? And he said, no, psychological issues don't create the pain. And I cited that in my brief. So that was the only evidence at trial. There was no evidence that it aggravated his pain. With reference to the question of opening the door, Your Honor, the question of opening the door, as I understand it, and I've tried a lot of cases, is if you say, my client has never been charged with a misdemeanor in his entire life, that would specifically open the door to the question, that in fact he had been. And it's questionable whether the opening statement would be sufficient to do that, but when you simply say my client, and I didn't get to finish my statement, the opening statement, but I can say my client is a decent guy based upon the testimony you're going to hear from all of these witnesses. I wasn't able to get that far because the court said, cut me off, sustained the objection, told the jury to disregard it, and presumably they followed the instruction. So there is no opening the door. If they did open some door, they closed it.
Although you did do it again in closing, and I don't mean to beat on you at all. I know you're an experienced lawyer, Mr. Wardick. I mean, I guess I suggest to you, maybe that's just your style, but it is dangerous when you start putting, if nothing else, offering a personal opinion, my client's a good guy.
Well,
and so I don't mean to ding on you, and I suggest to you down the road, may want to think about that in light of, so we wouldn't have to be here having this debate today.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Your Honor. On the closing argument, the evidence had come in from, I think there were 9 witnesses that said that they trusted him completely, with their cars, and he was the only mechanic they would go to, and we had a lot of other mechanics that said how excellent his skills were. And reasonably priced he was. And I felt it was appropriate to say that, I think that the evidence, and I had connected it directly to the evidence of the witnesses, and the court found it was proper comment at that point. With reference to whether or not that opened the door, I mean, I don't believe it did. They made no contemporaneous objection. During the closing argument, there was no objection. After the closing argument, the court, Judge Haglund, instructed the jury The jury adjourned and began deliberating. Several minutes after the jury was deliberating, the defense said, okay, they're talking to each other, we want to make a motion for mistrial. So the mistrial motion was made after the argument was concluded, after the jury began deliberating, and it was clearly waived under 103. The case law is clear that if you're going to make that kind of an objection, it has to be made contemporaneous with the statement they objected to, so that the trial court can take action to try to remedy any problem that the court might feel is there. And by not making the objection, the case law I cited indicates that it's waived, certainly after the jury starts deliberating on the case. With reference to some of the other issues, I think the court made it quite clear that there was supposed to be no mention of this incident and no mention of the charges based on his 403 analysis. And in spite of that, Mr. Rawson specifically asked about the incident without notifying the court in advance. That was not an issue that was, in my opinion, listed as an issue for review, but it was an ad hoc argument made during the case, and I don't think that it should be considered by the court. But if it were considered, I think that clearly the court had already ruled on the issue, and as the court pointed out to to the defense counsel, look, if this was such an important issue and you wanted to suggest that this caused some other injury to him, why didn't you bring it in the motion for in limine? And why didn't they ask my client about it on two depositions that he underwent, or any of the doctors who were deposed in the case, whether this being pushed into a sink, his butt into a sink, supposedly caused him injury to his neck? I mean, it just was a non-issue, and it was, in my opinion, not appropriately raised. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because you only got a minute and 20 seconds here. Could you respond to Mr. Epstein's argument about the continuance? I understand your point that your client said, you know, my pain's relieved, but he makes, it seems to me, a fairly powerful point. Mr. Epstein makes a fairly powerful point. You were seeking permanent impairment damages and loss of future earning capacity. And, you know, why wasn't a continuance appropriate to see where that would end up? And why was the second motion for continuance any different than the first one, which you stipulated to?
Well, Your Honor, the first motion for continuance was actually made by the two defendants. And I was contacted and asked if I opposed it, because I notified him he was going to require surgery. And I said, no, I don't oppose the motion. So it was on their dime that we did it. The surgery was performed. Our disclosures were, they conceded our disclosures were timely on the surgery. They requested a further deposition of my client, and we agreed, and it was taken. They asked for a further deposition or second deposition on Dr. Kumar, who was his treating doctor, and we agreed, and that was conducted before trial. They asked for an IME report from their examining physician, Dr. Bass, and that was agreed to, and that was conducted. After the surgery, my client was completely pain-free. What they're saying is we wanted a 12-month continuance. Had the continuance been granted on the issue of his pain, there are two possibilities. One, he is still pain-free, and the condition had really not changed from the date that the case was set for trial. The second possibility is his pain would have returned partially or completely. In that case, their position would have been much worse. So really, it's hard to imagine how they could have been prejudiced by not being granted a continuance in that situation. I mean, they haven't ever articulated any basis for it. And again, it's completely discretionary with the trial court whether to grant a continuance in that circumstance.
Thank you, Mr. Clerk.
Question, Your Honor.
You have. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I ask the bailiff to add a minute to Mr. Epstein's time? Mr. Kordick went over a little bit in response to my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the sink incident, That came up in the context of plaintiff's testimony regarding his physical condition, that he had gotten worse, but then, I believe, testified that there was some recovery. But then his condition worsened, and it was around the time that he was pushed into the sink. The cross-examination that defendant was attempting at that point was to tie in that the worsening of his physical condition with potentially the cause being pushed into the sink. And the evidence that was sought to be introduced was not the charges themselves at that point. It was the physical altercation. That evidence could have come in completely separate and apart from the charges themselves. And that was the point of the cross-examination. Dr. Henston, with respect to Dr. Henston's testimony, she did attribute a source of stress that was preventing plaintiff from recovering, at least in part, to the pending litigation involving these criminal charges. That's why defendant argues that that was relevant. With respect to the continuance issue, the point is not that plaintiff testified that he was pain-free. Our argument is defendant was entitled to assess his condition at the time that he reached maximum medical improvement, if you will, to determine by way of an IME whether in fact he could go back to work at that time. Whether he was pain-free wasn't particularly relevant to that issue, and that's why that was the guts of the continuance issue. And Your Honor is correct. The basis of the first motion for continuance, the factual background to the first one, is the same as the second one. The issue was, at what point in time could his physical condition be effectively analyzed to determine what the extent of his damages were at the time, or injuries were at the time of maximum medical improvement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. And thank you again, Mr. Kordick. We thank you both for your briefs and arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you.